The following program is a PodcastOne.com production. Recorded live backstage, this is Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. Now, here's your host, John Horn.
Hey, everybody. I'm John Horn. Today on Geffen Playhouse Unscripted, we have Wayne Brady. You probably know him best from Let's Make a Deal. He actually got his start playing Tigger at Walt Disney World. He passed out. It didn't go well, but he still has a career. Coming up next, Wayne Brady on Geffen Playhouse Unscripted.
Podcast One has crime and mystery with shows like Cold Case Files.
Unsure of how his victim was killed, the doctor completes his autopsy with more questions than answers.
The Serial Killer Podcast.
A little boy, as it turned out, was the kidnapped Billy Gaffney.
And crime in sports.
He's pulled over in Dallas and found in possession of a crack pipe. Let's just say the lawsuit didn't go anywhere. He didn't win.
Exclusively on Podcast One and Apple Podcasts.
Now back to Geffen Playhouse Unscripted.
Wayne Brady, welcome to Geffen Playhouse Unscripted.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I'm gonna go right to embarrassing jobs, because I think I stumbled across something that I saw about your working at a theme park when you were just starting out.
Wait a second. There's no such thing when you're starting off as an actor. That's not an embarrassing job to me.
That's a gig.
I worked at many theme parks. It's a job. And I'd say that like on the real. In fact, I dare go even further that I even tell my daughter, who's an aspiring actor and a performer, I tell her and her little friends, you know, I'm old enough to say her and her little friends, that I hope that when she turns 15 or 16, she gets cast at Disneyland, or she could do something at Universal Studios. That was invaluable training. Invaluable.
So Tigger, was that, do I have that right? Did you play Tigger somewhere? And how would you describe your Tigger? What did you imbue Tigger with in terms of like performance?
Well, I tried to imbue my Tigger with as much energy as possible, because my my whole game plan was, when I got hired at Disney, I was 15 turning 16, and I saw that there was a roster for number one Goofy, number one Tigger. Each of the character roles were numerated, and I wanted to know why were they numerated. And they said, well, eventually the top three people of these roles get all of the special bookings. So you get to be Goofy on a cruise ship, or you get to do like the special events, and like if there's a celebrity in town, you'll do the special event with them. I thought, well, that's going to be me. I'm going to be the number one Goofy or the number one Tigger. You can't stop me. That's what I'm going to do. So I said, when I'm Tigger, I'm going to have so much T-I-double-G-R, so much that it's going to knock you on your ass. And they're going to know my name, and they're going to know who I am, and I'm going to get the top slot. Turns out, my very first time out as Tigger, I was dancing in the parade, and I was dancing on a float that was a fiberglass wave on a surfboard. And it's 9,000 degrees in Florida. It's humid. I'm in a skin-tight, furry outfit with a fiberglass head on and a tail wrapped around my waist. Well, what do you think is going to happen, Wayne? I'm breakdancing. I'm jumping up and down the float. I'm running as fast as I can. Next thing I know, I wake up at the end of the parade. I'm face down on the float. The tail is cracked in half, and my head is turned all the way to the back so I couldn't even see. So to a whole generation of kids that happened to be in Disney World that day, it looked like Tigger had a massive coronary, passed out, and went to sleep. So I guess if there's anything embarrassing about it, it's that one.
Did you get to do that a second time, or was that one and done for Tigger?
Oh, no. Eventually, I did climb the ranks. I don't think I made it to number one Tigger, but I was one of the requested guys.
I think it's a great story. I mean, obviously, obviously, you know, the passing out from heat stroke or heat exhaustion is not a something you anticipated, but it does suggest something, which is that from the very earliest gig you had, you were going to crush it or not do it. And I think that's something that so many actors don't appreciate or understand, that you have one chance to make a first impression and you're only as good as your last job.
You know, that is true. And at the risk of sounding like that old man, I think that is a problem with today's crop of want-to-be performers. And I say want-to-be not in a disrespectful way, because I feel that you could be a performer as long as you've got the chops. You can call yourself that at any point. I say want-to-be in the sense of the people who sit at home and they watch a YouTube video. They go, haha, that's funny. I'm going to make a YouTube video. Now I'm an actor. Well, no, you're a dude that made a YouTube video. That's what you are. You didn't put in the work. And it's not as easy. It's worked out for a lot of those kids, for some of those YouTubers who are actually good and they've used YouTube as a stepping stone. But for the people that want shortcuts, there's no shortcut. There's no shortcut. So that's why, going back to the first question, when I say there is no embarrassing gig, you do everything you can to be in show business. So my whole goal when I moved out here was I was not going to be a waiter, not because I looked down on the profession of waiting tables, but because if I'm waiting tables and you walk up to me and you say, Wayne, what do you do? And I go, well, I'm an actor, I'm a singer, I'm a dancer. And you go, that's awesome. Now get me my coffee. That's a problem to me. So I said, no matter what the gig is, whether it's in a character costume, whether it's doing street theater, whether it's doing Ren Fairs or singing on a cruise ship, I'm going to be in showbiz. So I wish that like we had more kids that had that this is all I live for type mentality.
No, and that makes me think of like the kid who thinks he can play, you know, in college or professional basketball because his dad knows the guy who's the assistant at the Bulls. And it's like, I don't care who you know. Are you in the gym practicing your free throws? Are you doing the work that makes it necessary? And I think that's the difference between actors who want to act and actors who want to be celebrities or stars. And they're very different things. And I think a lot of actors, you probably agree, focus on the celebrity as opposed to the craft.
Amen. In fact, I have a lot of these talks with my daughter because she's a sponge and she wants to learn. And I don't profess to be some great guru. All I can do is speak from my experience. And I tell her that, baby, you are looking at an incredibly fortunate guy, because before Whose Line, before I got Whose Line in 99, I had already been a working actor since the year that I graduated high school, which was 1989. So I was working for 10 years, busting my ass, stumbling into jobs, being bad. Like I know there's a video of Chorus Line from the Mark II Dinner Theater in Orlando, Florida, online. And I'm probably the worst Richie that has ever done that role. And I'll own it. I had no business dancing it. Now, I sang the crap out of it, but a ballet dancer, I am not. So that's like 10 years of stumbling around and trying to become good until someone goes, oh, you're good at that. So I tell her, you know, it's all about the long game. And you can be famous. Anyone can be famous or anyone can be infamous. But will you work forever? That's the plan. Like when I was 16, I said, all I want is to work until I can't walk anymore or until I can't breathe. That's my goal. So even if it meant doing regional theater forever, doing cruise ships, doing dinner theater, I just wanted to be on stage. And the fame part of it sucks, because if that's your litmus test or your goalpost, then you're setting yourself up, because not everyone lucks into that. And I do mean luck into it. You've got to be prepared. But let's be real. Not everyone in the movies that we watch or the TV shows that we enjoy is good. And that's not throwing shade at anyone in particular. It's just the reality.
There are so many actors that I know, when you talk to them about why they became actors, they talk about things that acting gives them that they may not be personally, that they can be an introverted person and they can be an extrovert through acting. They're kind of shy. They get to be outgoing. They're not usually talkative. They get to be vocal. And I think it's often the case that sometimes acting gives a performer something that they're not naturally. And I think it's often the case that the opposite is true. But I'm wondering if acting complemented or suggested to you a different way of being that you couldn't be in your own skin or in your own self.
Every day, every single day. It's such a gift. I still am, like a lot of, you know, our ilk, I'm still that very nerdy. And I don't mean nerdy in the cool way where now everyone says, well, I'm a nerd too. Mm-mm, no, you play video games. That doesn't mean that you're a nerd. When I say nerd, I mean the kid, especially a kid from my neighborhood, a kid from the hood, the black kid that other kids didn't think was black enough, that I watched PBS, I watched Masterpiece Theater, Upstairs, Downstairs, Monty Python. I was a John Cleese fan at the same time that I was a Run DMC fan. I was that kid reading Jules Verne and reading Shakespeare and putting on radio plays in my room. No one knew that because I would have died if anyone outside of my house knew that I was doing those things. So I'm still that kid, even today. So even when I do something, let's say, even when I'm hosting a show like Let's Make a Deal and I'm doing my thing, that's not really Wayne. That's the Wayne that can talk to people and make fun of people and tell jokes. When I was just in Hamilton as Burr, that Wayne that got to do Burr is definitely 10 times cooler than the guy sitting in front of you now. So you're exactly right. Each role or every time that you perform in public, it gives you a chance. It's almost totemic. It gives you the powers of whatever you have. If you're playing an ass, then you get a chance to be loud and brazen. You get the chance to be evil. You get a chance to be the smartest guy in the room, even if you're not the smartest guy in the room. It's a beautiful thing. It's the best game of make-believe.
I have talked to actors who have done a lot of work on soap operas, and they talk about the training that you can get from doing a daytime show. But I'm wondering if there's an equivalent that you get from doing a game show, if it's Don't Forget the Lyrics or Let's Make a Deal, that gives you something as an actor that you don't necessarily have in another setting.
I think it's the other way around to a degree. I think I can do those shows because of what being an actor has given me. It makes it possible to step into those shoes. I'm able to be facile and fast on my feet and deal with people because of my improv background. And that makes it a different experience for me as opposed to someone who just grabs a microphone and says, tell him what he won, Bob, because that's not my personal gig. That's not what I do. I think what I have learned from doing the game show, especially from doing Let's Make a Deal, is that I've tried to take into my acting is patience and a sense of calm. Because like some of us, and I've talked about this in the past, about depression and anxiety, it's the weirdest gig to be in the middle of a couple hundred screaming people with your back to them, which is contrary to everything that you learn on stage. With your back towards the audience, playing towards the camera, and everyone's yelling and screaming and either wanting money or they want you to sing or they want you to dance. Rah, 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 rah. So I've had to learn to, even in the midst of that, be able to take it down a notch internally. And I actually did use that recently when I was in Chicago, particularly during the second act in Hamilton, when Uptown happens and you have to be still for a long time. I'm not good at being still, even if it's choreographed. And that took a lot. So I had to take the training from Let's Make a Deal in terms of calm down now, buddy, bring it down a notch to be able to settle in and really be in my skin. So that's a pretty cool gift to take away from it.
When you were growing up, I think I read that you had a stutter. And I'm wondering, when you're thinking about becoming an actor, if part of what drives you to become an actor is that an obvious impediment to acting would be to have a speech impediment. And were you at all motivated to become an actor because there was something that people noticed that you couldn't do in terms of speaking, and you wanted to prove them wrong or prove yourself right?
That's a great question, but the answer really is no. When I stuttered, and I've talked about this, and I even just did a really great event honoring stutterers in the world and in the profession and raising money for the Stuttering Institute. My stuttering was brought upon by, I really think, my social anxiety and all of the baggage that I carried, feeling bullied and feeling different. And I did it to myself. So that combined with, I think, my brain, it's always working. And sometimes, you know, the saying about your mouth moving faster than your brain, that's when the tangling happens, because it's the opposite. My brain will go, oh, let's do this, blah, 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 blah. And my mouth goes, oh, you mean blah, and I know that it's going to screw up as soon as it comes out of my mouth, because I can't control whatever the emotion is to get that thing out. So I think I worked on that, and it's something that I still deal with if I'm incredibly worked up, but I find that it never happens if it's a script or even when I'm on stage doing improvisation, because I'm in a different mindset. Or even when you're singing, you know, like the famous singer Mel Tillis, his stuttering went away. I don't know if you know him, a country singer. He had a stutter. He was in that fine piece of awesomeness back in the day. I think he was either in Cannonball Run, or he was in oh my God, I can see it now. It's a trucking movie. Damn, I can't think of it. But back in the 70s, Mel Tillis was big. But he had a stutter. He could barely get a sentence out. But then when he sang, this beautiful voice. So I've learned about the connection in the mind between the singing and acting versus that. So sometimes I just turn on the piece of my brain that I use if I feel I've got to give material, and the stutter goes away.
The other thing that I think is important that you've done is you've done improv. And I think improv training is incredibly valuable for every actor. And it's not something that a lot of actors do, because I think the stakes are so high in improv. The risk of failure is monumental. But I'm wondering, you started doing improv training really early in your career. How has it changed you and improved you as an actor? And how would you be if you hadn't studied improv today?
That's another great question. You know, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you if I hadn't have been involved with the company that I started in Orlando, SAC Theater. And those guys are amazing. And the theater that we started, it's still there. I'd like to think that improvisation is one of those other things that nerdy kid did in his room. All I had was me. And I had my little sister every blue moon, but she really didn't live with me. So I was my best playmate. So at that point, I thought nothing of creating these stories. And when I'm playing with my action figures or when I'm drawing, I would cartoon, I'm voicing everything and just making the story up. And it was the best TV. It was the absolute best TV, because when you can't watch TV, you make your own TV in your head. So the natural extension for me was when I lucked into meeting the woman that was my teacher. Her name is Claire. And now she's out here in Hollywood. She's a big time screenwriter. She was the one that said, hey, you've got something. Let's teach you improv. And it's because of my training in Orlando that I was able to move out here. And I think I have the confidence to walk into most situations. I'm not saying I'm not scared and that it isn't ridiculously daunting and it scares me shitless sometimes, but I am I'm okay with it because I've got a bag of tools. And when you talk about actors being afraid of studying improv because of the stakes, I think what actors end up doing is, and this is what I make up, that they go, oh, no, I'm no good at that improv stuff. Like I see you guys do on that Who's Line, like the What Line show, I can't do that. And I tell them, I say, you're not supposed to. If everyone did it, it wouldn't be that particular art. But you still need the training. You even need the fundamentals, because even if you just take the two basic rules from improv, you can lay them on top of whatever your project is. The yes and, yep. Which means you have to listen. So instead of being that guy that you're in a scene, and you can see this on stage when it's a two-hander and someone is giving it to you, but you're in another place and, oh, okay, I can't wait. As soon as he finishes, I'm going to turn and it's going to be amazing. Because you're already done.
Right.
As soon as you've had that thought, you're done. You need to yes and him, even if it isn't a verbal yes and. You have to listen to everything that person's saying and take it in and have your response come from that place. And the listening alone is a valuable tool. Some actors by nature, we are narcissists, so we barely listen to other people except ourselves. You have to listen to other people. Otherwise it doesn't work. So to anyone listening, get your behind to an improv class. It doesn't need to be the Groundlings or Second City. It can be, but go someplace. Just get comfortable with words coming out of your mouth that aren't written by someone else, because you may go up. And I've been saved a few times from just going blank. And I said, maybe it's not the author's intention, but something is going to come out. You will never know that I forgot this line.
When you're talking like that, I'm thinking about the skills that are essential to an audition, to be able to react to a scene in the moment. If somebody, a casting director, or somebody you're reading with is going to throw you a curve, you have to be ready, and you have to be ready to go with it. And I want to talk about your audition for Chicago back in 2004 when you joined the Broadway revival of Chicago. Do you remember your tryout for that? I'm hoping there was an audition. And if so, do you remember what happened?
Well, I'm going to have to say there was no audition for that. That was a straight offer. It doesn't mean I wasn't scared, because that was my Broadway debut. But I will say I'll do you better than Chicago and skip over a couple and say, even when I auditioned for Hamilton, I was auditioning for Hamilton in front of friends of mine, in front of Thomas Kail and Lynn and Alex Lacamoire. I was auditioning for the Dream Team, who I've hung out with and I've done other projects with. And I was so nervous that you try to not get that tremolo thing going on. It's not your vibrato when you sing, but it's that little, oh, hey guys, it's so great to see you. So I actually did mess up. I messed up when I was doing Room Where It Happens. And I thought, okay, I can stop or I can just keep going. And then maybe they'll give me a second chance to redo it, because I'm hoping they'll give me the benefit of the doubt that they know that I don't suck. I opted to keep going. And I would recommend that in any audition, unless you know you have completely tanked it, because it's better to have control of your audition. So if you feel, oh no, I have to keep going and I'll steer it, then do that. But if you feel you need to stop, okay, cool. Stop, set a second, and readjust. But you've got to be ready, because then I was throwing songs that I wasn't prepared for. And you may freak out about that. That's your opportunity to show them. And it's taken me this long in the business. I just turned 45 and I've just gotten to the point where I go, okay, I'm not going to look at this as the end of the world if I screw this audition up. I'm going to look at it as, this is my opportunity to do a little show. Like, These pages are my show. Even if no one else sees it except these guys, I'm going to do my show.
How do you make a part your own when you are inheriting a part that other actors have played? I mean, it could be Aaron Burr. We've had Joshua Henry on the podcast, who's done his Aaron Burr. You did Billy Flynn in Chicago. There are performances that are inevitably indelible at some level. So how do you make a performance your own when there's enough information and familiarity with what others might have done with it?
I think I'm choosing my words because I'm trying to not sound like I know the answers, because someone listening might say, well, that's crap. What has worked for me, especially recently stepping into those shoes after Leslie and after Josh, is I realize that it's a simple equation, and you can do this for any role. I'm getting ready to do this I'm joining the cast of Colony on USA, the sci-fi drama. And I thought, okay, what can I do? You have to be yourself. It sounds corny, even though you're playing a character and doing someone like Burr. He already has all that information, like you said. When I looked at Leslie's Burr, which, God, the first time I saw him do that show, I cried like a little baby, both out of being moved and out of jealousy. I saw a man who was very driven. His Burr, super driven. The world will not stop that man from succeeding. That, to my knowledge of what I know of Leslie and meeting him, that's Leslie, and it served him well. Joshua has a Sidney Poitier elegance about him, but he has that in real life. That's what I observed of Josh. So I look at Burr and I go, okay, what are you going to do, Wayne? And you know, there's going to be a lot of people that go, oh, what the hell? Why is Wayne doing it? So what are you going to do? And I thought, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to bring what I feel is a weapon in my case. I'm going to be myself. I'm going to be open, and I'm going to be his friend. I'm going to be Hamilton's friend, and I'm going to be charming, and I'm going to be as effervescent as one can be when you walk in the door. So that I informed Burr to be a bright presence and a big brother to Hamilton, so that by the time that we reach the point where we square off, I've earned the right to go dark. So I just thought, I'll just bring light, because I feel that with some of the work I do, like, well, Let's Make a Deal and other things, that's what people know me for. That's what they expect. That's what I feel is a gift. I can make a room smile. So I thought, it's my mission to make Hamilton smile. I'm going to make that dude so happy. Before I kill him. Yeah. So I think you have to bring pieces of yourself. Find out what you can insert in whatever the role is, and make that yours.
I want to ask you about collaborating with directors. You mentioned Tommy Kail, who directed Hamilton. You also work with Neil Patrick Harris, who did a revival of Rent. The Hollywood Bowl, which I saw, where you were playing Tom Collins. When you're working with a director and you're trying to grow as an actor, and maybe you don't have a lot of rehearsal time, what do you get from working with somebody who is effective? What do you need him or her to tell you? And how do you become a better actor through the people who are directing you? Not the people you're acting opposite, but the people who are giving you direction.
Once again, I think it's kind of simple. You listen. You absolutely listen. I'm not saying trust blindly, because what I've also learned after all these years in the business is and rarely does this happen, and I've lucked out, working with Neil, working with Thomas, working with Michael Arden, there are people that you trust what they do, and you hope that it's reciprocated. They also trust you. So if they tell me something, I'm really going to listen to it, and I'm going to follow it within those boundaries, and I'm going to see if it works. I'm going to work what they've given me as hard as possible. Now, I do think there's a certain point where maybe it doesn't work for you. Then you have to have an honest conversation. You don't have to have a fight. You don't have to have a budding of wills. But if you're both on the same page trying to create something, just listen, because hopefully that director has earned that place. And I'm a big believer in give that man or woman their respect and give them their due. And that's just been ingrained in me since I was a kid.
I think we're living in incredibly complicated times. And I think the role of the artist has never been more important. You're also a parent. And as you're thinking about what you want to bring into the world as an artist, do you find yourself thinking differently, maybe since the election, about the kinds of things that you want to do and the kinds of things you don't want to do, and what an artist can start in terms of a conversation with his or her audience?
I've absolutely thought about that. I've thought about my my ex-wife and I have a production company, and we've been lucky enough to place a couple projects around town. And when I've gone into the meetings, I've said, look, what I would love to be able to bring with some of these projects is I want to bring responsibility. I just don't want to create something just for giggles. Oh, look, this is a funny sitcom. Yeah, that's cool. Or this is a reality show. That's great. But I almost feel that we do live in such dire times that as much as we need to entertain, especially as a Black man and especially as a father and as a performer, I feel that it's my duty now to contribute. I need to raise my voice somehow. And I think it's our responsibility. You just can't sit on the sidelines and grouse about it. I have no patience for the Trump haters who say, Trump is horrible. He blah, blah, blah. And then it comes out in a conversation, well, who'd you vote for? You know, well I didn't do it because my vote doesn't count anyway because of the Electoral College. And that's why, and if you knew your history, and I said, oh, no. I know my history and I know my civics. Thank you. But let's just say that the average person's vote didn't count. Even just the act of getting out there and the solidarity of merging with these other people and being of the same mind, that can affect change. So I think it's absolutely the performer's responsibility now to whether you're doing a game show, whether you're doing a theatrical piece, whether you're doing music, you have to, at some point, you have to carry a message. I'm not saying be a torchbearer. You don't have to carry a cause on your shoulders, but I have to do something. I've got a little mixed race daughter that is looking to me for guidance to see how she should handle certain situations, and I'm not going to let her down.
Let me ask you this last question. I think it's easy to talk about Hamilton in terms of the impact that the music has, the way in which it's brought American history alive. We're not going to talk about the ticket prices, but I think there's something that is lost in the conversation about Hamilton, and that is the young people who are lucky enough to get into a show can look on stage and they can see people of color, they can see women, they can see a cast that looks like the country, not like the country club up there on stage. Mm. And I think for
that's
those
a great
people,
line. I'm going to steal that.
Go ahead. And I think for those people who are considering a life in the arts, the idea and the chance to see yourself at a future age on stage is irreplaceable. How important are shows like Hamilton to that next generation of performers to say, you know what, you're in this, you can do this, because this is you up on stage?
Wow. I think that Hamilton is important for all of those reasons. I think that every blue moon, something comes across, whether it's a movie or whether it's a piece of American theater or it's a film, something comes along that just breaks every rule and then makes its own rules. And that's what Lin did with Hamilton. And it's actually pretty simple. I mean, once you get past the genius level writing and the song and the songwriting and the structure and everything, it's simple. He said, you know, I want to see people that look like me. And that is one, that's the example of art affecting life. If enough of these young kids see all these people of different colors and hues and genders on stage, then it's not a shell shock to them, that it's not something to work towards, then it's not a big deal. Like folks go crazy because, you know, using Joshua Henry, for example, getting ready to do Billy Bigelow. Oh my God, it's amazing. And he's black. And what's awesome is the implications of this black man. But wouldn't it be great if he just did the role? Wouldn't it be awesome? It would just be a great thing. But that comes from, we've had decades and decades and decades of years of the baseline to a lot of people being white. So anything outside of that, white and male. So anything outside of that had to have been a special case or some weird aberration or something's wrong, or we're going to hell in a handbasket. Shows like this, when these shows become the norm, then we won't have these issues to fight against. We're human, so we'll make up other issues to fight. But at least it won't be race and it won't be gender equality. And I live for that day.
I'm going to end with one little quiz. You are on Let's Make a Deal. For people who don't know, they can Google it. There's something called the Monty Hall problem. You know what it is, Wayne?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, I do.
So for people who don't know, the Monty Hall problem, there are three doors, 1, 2, and 3. Behind one of the doors is a car. Behind two of the doors is a goat. Somebody comes on and they say to Wayne, I'm going to pick door number one. Wayne knows maybe what's behind it. So he opens door number three and it's a goat. Do you change your pick to door number two? You don't know. You've chosen door number one. Do you change your pick to door number two? Wayne, what's the right answer?
Wait, what's the question again?
It's the Monty Hall problem. Do you change your pick? You there's three doors. There's a goat behind two of them, a car behind one of them. You pick door number one. Your host shows you door number three. It's got a goat behind it. There's two doors covered, one and two. Do you change your pick from one to two?
I would switch.
You do switch. People will hate this because they say the odds haven't changed. The odds have gone from 1 out of 3 to 1 out of 2. You can Google it. It's the Monty Hall problem. Wayne Brady, thanks for coming on Geffen Playhouse Unscripted.
Thank you so much for having me. So it's Geffen Playhouse today, and then tomorrow maybe I'll be at the Geffen Playhouse. I love that.
You better be, and behind door number one might be your next job at the Geffen Playhouse.
Amen.
Have a great evening. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much, sir.
That was Wayne Brady on Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. And if you like what you heard, you can check out past episodes. And while you're enjoying more from Geffen Playhouse Unscripted, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or at podcastone.com. And don't forget to rate, review, and share. I'm John Horn. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. Download new episodes every Wednesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or subscribe at iTunes.